Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're setting our sights on the Afrin region. Specifically, we want to explore the Sufi traditions that were really alive there, you know, before 2010.
Right, Afrin. It's historically known as Kurdah, the Mountain of the Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
And geographically, it's that area north of Aleppo, right up against the Turkish border. Before the Syrian civil war, it really stood out because its population was overwhelmingly ethnic Kurdish, kind of a unique spot within Syria, demographically speaking.
So what we're trying to do today is draw on the research about Sufism in Kurdah from that pre-2010 period.
Exactly. We want to understand, you know, the key parts of how Sufism was practiced there, what role it played in day-to-day life, and how it connected with Kurdish identity in that particular place.
We'll be looking at the different Sufi orders present, the importance of their institutions like the lodges, the zawiyas, and, well, the rituals and sacred places that really define things.
Unpacking that whole spiritual landscape.
Okay, let's start painting that picture. Afrin before 2010. Tell us a bit about the place itself. What was it like?
Well, geographically, you're talking about the Afrin River Valley. Lots of forested hills, fertile land, famous for its olive groves, of course, but other agriculture, too.
Right. The olives are key.
Definitely. And its location, north of Aleppo, close to that Turkish border drawn back in 1923, that's really shaped its history.
And the people. You mentioned overwhelmingly Kurdish.
Yeah, around 360 villages, mostly Kurdish. The majority were Sunni Muslims. But you also had Yazidi communities and some Alevis, too. Some Alevi families actually settled there after the Dersim events in Turkey.
Interesting. And the Kurdish identity, was it mainly religious or cultural?
Primarily ethnic and cultural, really. You'd hear Kurmanji spoken widely, especially north of Medanki, and traditional Kurdish clothing was quite common to see.
So a strong sense of cultural identity, how does that fit into the longer history?
Oh, the history there is deep. You got Syro-Hittite sites like Ain Dara, Roman ruins at Saris.
Right.
It was part of Roman Syria. Then came the Muslim conquests, Ottoman rule. It was part of Kilis province. Then the French mandate period after World War I. And eventually it became part of modern Syria.
And its relationship with the Syrian state before 2010?
It was complex. The central government in Damascus implemented what sources call heavy-handed Arabization policies.
Mm-hmm.
But despite that tension, the region itself was relatively peaceful before the civil war kicked off in 2011. And economically, the ties to Aleppo were absolutely vital. Well, that olive oil we mentioned, a lot of it went to Aleppo for its famous soap industry. Plus, many Kurds from Afrin went to Aleppo for university, and the area even attracted some Syrian tourists.
Okay, so you have this strong Kurdish area tied economically to Aleppo with this long history under Syrian state control. And within that context, Sufism really thrived. It's called a distinctive Sufi Kurdish tradition. What made it distinctive?
It seems to be a combination of things. That strong Kurdish identity we talked about, for one. Then its relative geographic isolation probably allowed unique local traditions to develop.
It wasn't totally isolated, given the Aleppo connection.
Exactly. That economic link to a big cosmopolitan city like Aleppo is crucial. And finally, the specific mix of Sufi orders that became established there. All these factors together seemed to create a Sufi environment that some observers felt was maybe less rigid, perhaps more tolerant than elsewhere.
Let's dive into those Sufi orders then. The research mentions the Rifa'iyya, the Naqshbandiyya, and the Qadiriyya. Which ones were most prominent in Afrin itself before 2010?
It's interesting because while the Naqshbandiyya and Qadiriyya have historically been very strong among Kurds generally,
right,
in Afrin, specifically before 2010, the Rifa'iyya order seems to have had a particularly strong visible presence.
Okay, the Rifa'iyya.
And just to recap, Sufism is that mystical inner dimension of Islam. It's organized around these spiritual paths or orders, the tariqas.
Led by sheikhs, with followers called murids, gathering in zawiyas, the lodges.
Precisely. And leading up to 2010, Syria actually saw something of a Sufi revival. There was a real popular interest in personal piety and practicing faith together communally.
So it wasn't just abstract belief.
Not at all. In Afrin, Sufism was very much a lived religion, woven into the social structures, the relationships between sheikhs and murids, the life centered around the zawiya.
Okay, tell us more about the Rifa'iyya in Afrin then. Who were the big names?
The central figure seems to have been Sheikh Mahmud al-Husseini. He led a major zawiya right in Afrin town.
In the main town itself.
Yes. And his influence wasn't just local. He had followers among the Kurdish communities that had migrated to Aleppo and even as far as Damascus.
Wow. And what was the basis of his authority?
He claimed a direct spiritual lineage, a silsila going all the way back to the founder, Ahmad al-Rifai himself, and also to Ali ibn Abi Talib, who is obviously a hugely revered figure.
And their practices. The research mentions embodied mystical experiences. That sounds intense.
It does. The rituals in Sheikh Mohammed Zawiya really emphasize this. A key part was the public display of karamat.
Miraculous deeds.
That's often how it's translated, yes. Things seen by followers as proof of the Sheikh's baraka, his spiritual power, granted by God.
And where would people see these?
Mainly during the weekly hadra. That's the main communal gathering focused on dhikr, remembering God. That was the setting for these demonstrations.
What kind of demonstrations are we talking about?
Well, ethnographic accounts from that time describe some pretty dramatic things. Darb al-Shis, that's a form of ritual piercing.
Piercing.
Yes. Also, things like walking over burning coals, apparently even ingesting glass. They also performed healing rituals, sometimes involving the expulsion of jinns.
Goodness. That's quite something. Why such intense physical displays? What was the point?
It seems this performative element was absolutely crucial for establishing and cementing Sheikh Mahmud's spiritual authority.
How so?
Well, think about it. These very visible acts, seeming to defy normal physical limits, would have been powerful proof of his special connection, his baraka. It likely attracted followers, solidified their faith.
So it wasn't just about personal experience, but also about public validation.
Absolutely. It offered a sense of divine power and protection, which would have resonated strongly in that environment. It publicly validated his status.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. What about the Naqshbandiya? They often have a reputation for emphasizing Sharia law and sometimes getting involved in social or political issues. How did that play out in Afrin?
The Naqshbandiya were definitely influential, too. Their lineage goes back through Abu Bakr. And yes, they often emphasize Sharia adherence.
A different flavor than the Rifaya, perhaps.
Often, yes. Their dhikr can be silent or contemplative, though not always. And historically, they have engaged in socio-political matters. In Syria generally, the Khalidi branch, spread by the Kurdish Sheikh Khalid al-Baghdadi, was very important.
And in Afrin specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Any key figures?
Yes, Sheikh Hasan al-Naqshbandi. He was widely seen as the Sheikh al-Mashik, sort of the chief sheikh in Afrin. His Zawiya was a pilgrimage site, and his grandfather was even revered as a local saint.
So a respected lineage there, too.
Definitely. But you also can't talk about the Naqshbandiya in Afrin without mentioning the Murid movement from the 1930s.
Ah, yes, you mentioned that connection earlier. Tell us more.
It was led by Halil Ibrahim Sokokolu, known as the Naqshi Sheikh. It was this fascinating mix of Naqshbandi leadership, addressing real social problems like poverty and landowner issues and resistance against the French mandate authorities.
And they were based at Nabi Huri.
That's right. They used the shrine complex as their headquarters. It really shows how religious authority, social grievances, and political resistance could all come together under that Naqshbandi banner in Afrin at that time.
So the Naqshbandi role wasn't just spiritual guidance.
The Murid movement shows it could be much more activist, certainly. Later figures like Sheikh Hasan might have focused more on spiritual matters and maintaining the networks.
Which were extensive, right? Connecting Kurds across Syria and into Turkey.
Exactly. Those networks were very important. But that earlier movement shows the potential for fusing religious authority with social and political struggle in that specific Kurdish context.
Okay, and the third order mentioned is the Qadiriyya. How did they fit into the picture in Afrin before 2010? The sources seem to suggest they were maybe less prominent within Afrin itself.
That seems to be the case, yes. The Qadiriyya, founded by Abd al-Qadir al-Jilani, is one of the oldest orders with a big historical following among Kurds.
But maybe less so in Afrin by this period.
It seems its direct influence might have lessened somewhat in Afrin, perhaps overshadowed by the rise of the Naqshbandiya locally. The Qadiriyya did face challenges elsewhere in Syria too, sometimes declining in urban areas like Hama.
But they weren't absent from the wider region.
Not at all. In Aleppo, for instance, Sheikh Muhyi al-Din led a very active Qadiriyya Zawiya. And here's an interesting connection. Sheikh Muhyi al-Din himself had actually been a Murid, a disciple of Sheikh Hasan al-Naqshbandi back in Afrin.
Ah, so there are links between the orders. There's not like they existed in separate boxes.
Precisely. That's a crucial point. Followers of Sheikh Muhyi al-Din from Aleppo would actually make pilgrimages to Sheikh Hasan's Naqshbandi Zawiya in Afrin.
that really shows active ties and respect.
It does. And there were broader Kurdish Qadiri networks connecting Aleppo with other regions too. So it's possible Afrin was linked in ways that aren't as heavily documented. The whole Sufi scene was fluid personal relationships, shared respect for figures, pilgrimages. It created this complex web of connections.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady's here. Roj Bosch Hannah. Fantastic timing. Could really use a cup.
Ah, wonderful. Yes, please.
Okay, feeling refreshed. Thanks, Hannah. Let's get back to it. We were talking about the connections. Let's look at the institutions themselves. The Zawiya, the Sufi Lodge, seems absolutely central in Afrin.
It really was the cornerstone. Places like Sheikh Mahmoud's Rifai Zawiya or Sheikh Hassan's Mashbandi. One, they were the heart of Sufi organization and practice.
More than just a place to pray.
Oh, much more. They were hubs for community religious life. Yes, the weekly hadra with the dikr happened there, spiritual teaching.
Where the Sheikh's Baraka was demonstrated in the Rifai case.
Exactly. But there were also social centers, cultural anchors for the community, and they played a really important role supporting people who moved from the villages in Afrin to Aleppo.
Support networks for migrants.
Yes, absolutely. And in the rural parts of Kurdog, the authority of the Sheikh operating out of the Zawiya was deeply respected.
Let's talk more about that authority. How was leadership structured?
Generally, it was hierarchical. You have the Sheikh, the spiritual guide, or murshid, leading the followers, the murids.
And that relationship was formalized.
Often through what's called the bay'ah, an oath of allegiance the murid takes. Then the Sheikh might appoint deputies, caliphs.
What do they do?
They'd manage groups of followers in different places, supervise things, maybe collect contributions.
And what gave the Sheikh his authority? Was it just lineage?
Lineage of the silsila was important, yes. But also their perceived spiritual power, the baraka, sometimes shown through karamat, as we discussed. And then there's personal charisma, teaching skill, spiritual guidance, their overall standing.
And they acted as community leaders in other ways, too.
Often, yes. As social mediators, resolving disputes, sometimes representing the community's interests to outside authorities.
Like Sheikh Mahmoud mediating with the state sometimes, or Sugu Kolu leading the Murid movement.
Exactly. Those examples show how their influence could stretch beyond the purely spiritual.
You mentioned the Zawiyas supporting migrants in Aleppo. It sounds like these Sufi networks were really vital bridges between rural Afrin and the city.
They were crucial conduits, not just for people, but for goods, for ideas flowing between Kurdah and Aleppo.
How did the Aleppo Zawiyas help migrants specifically?
Well, a place like Sheikh Muhyiddin's Qadiri Lodge offered solidarity, a community connection. It helped people navigate a new, complex urban environment.
And helped them stay connected to their roots.
Yes, definitely. These networks helped maintain Kurdish cultural identity in the city. For instance, using Kurmanji in some rituals helped preserve the language.
So moving to the city didn't mean cutting ties?
Not necessarily, because the networks facilitated keeping those ties strong. Followers maintained allegiance to sheikhs back in Afrin, like Sheikh Hassan, and people would make pilgrimages ziyarat back to sacred sites in Kurdog, like Nabi Huri.
It sounds like an informal but really effective social infrastructure.
That's a good way to put it. Managing migration, preserving identity, keeping economic and social links alive between the rural and urban areas.
Okay, let's zoom in on the rituals and practices again. We know dikr was central.
Absolutely fundamental, that remembrance of God usually done together in the weekly hadra at the Zawiya.
What's the goal of dikr?
It's about cultivating that deep connection, emotional, embodied with the divine. Sometimes it can lead to mystical states.
And it looked different depending on the order.
It could, yes. Chanting, breathing techniques, specific movements. Sometimes music, especially in some Qadiri traditions. And as we saw with the Rifia under Sheikh Mahmud, the hadra was also the stage for performing karamat.
And besides the weekly hadra, were there other big communal events?
Maulids were important. These are celebrations for the birthday of a Prophet Muhammad or sometimes major saints. They could be large gatherings, often involving pilgrimages, ziyarat to relevant shrines.
Let's revisit those karamat and the idea of embodied mysticism, especially the Darb al-Sheesh. It seems so central to the Rifaiya practice in Afrin.
It does seem particularly prominent there. Sufism often involves transforming the self through disciplined practice, and the body can be central to that.
But the public karamat seemed like another level.
Right. These miracles were seen as divine gifts, proving the Sheikh's baraka. The Darb al-Sheesh, the piercing, walking on coals, eating glass, these were performed publicly during the Hajar.
Why the Darb al-Sheesh specifically? Why that practice?
It's a really powerful example of embodied charisma. By publicly showing mastery over pain attributed to divine protection, the Sheikh dramatically legitimized his spiritual authority.
So it really worked to draw people in.
It seems so. It became a hallmark of Refi piety in that local context. And the fact that it was public was key. It was social validation of his spiritual status.
Okay. Now, shifting from practices to places, sacred spaces, the shrine of Nabi Huri keeps coming up. It sounds incredibly significant for Afrin.
It absolutely was. Pilgrimage, Diyarat, is a big part of Sufi life, generally visiting places to seek blessings, baraka, from saints, awliya, or prophets remembering sacred history.
And Nabi Huri was the main one in Afrin.
By far the most prominent. It's located near the ruins of ancient Cyrus, and the most striking feature is this hexagonal Roman tower tomb.
Roman. So it predates Islam.
Yes, 2nd or 3rd century CE, likely a mausoleum originally. Local tradition connects Nabi Huri with Uriah the Hittite from the Bible.
Fascinating. How did it become an Islamic shrine?
During the Mamluk period around 1303, that Roman tomb was converted into a Muslim shrine for Nabi Huri. A mosque was built next to it, later rebuilt in the Ottoman era.
And how did Sufis view Nabi Huri?
Some saw him as a sort of prophetic predecessor. Popular belief often treated him like a powerful local Sufi saint who could grant wishes.
So it drew people for various reasons.
Definitely. It was a real focal point for religious life. Sufis made pilgrimages there. Kurds came from nearby villages. Visitors from Aleppo with ties to Afrin. It brought together religious devotion, local stories, and a sense of belonging to that land.
And it had other roles, too.
Yeah, it was a popular spot for families to visit, just for an outing. And crucially, as we discussed, it was the headquarters for the Naqshbandi Murid movement in the 1930s.
It really embodies so many layers of history.
Exactly. Roman, biblical, Mamluk, Ottoman, Sufi, Kurdish identity, modern politics.
Yeah.
All converging in one place. That made it a really powerful unifying symbol for the region.
Let's dig a bit deeper into that historical political side, specifically the Murid movement. Based at Nabi Huri, led by a Naqshbandi sheikh. It sounds like a really key moment.
A pivotal event, for sure. This was an uprising during the French Mandate, led by Halil Ibrahim Sodoukulu, the Naqshi Sheikh. He set up base at Nabi Huri around 1929.
What was driving it? Was it purely religious?
Not solely, no. While it drew on Naqshbandi authority, it was really fueled by the tough socioeconomic situation. It mobilized poor Kurdish peasants against local landowners, the Agas, who were often seen as collaborating with the French.
So it had a social justice element.
Very much so. They pushed for literacy, religious education, and took an anti-feudal populist stance. And politically, they were clearly anti-French.
What about its wider connections? Did it have allies?
It was complex. They got some initial backing from the Syrian national bloc, but they also had strong ties with Turkey, especially around the time Turkey was pushing to annex the Sanjak of Alexandretta nearby.
So Turkish involvement or influence?
There are suggestions Turkey supported the movement, possibly with an eye on potentially annexing Kurd-Dağ itself. It's debated. For a while, the Murids ran a sort of local administration in parts of Afrin, trying to implement Islamic principles.
How did it end?
The French military intervened decisively in 1939. They suppressed the movement, and Sodoukulu and many followers had to flee to Turkey.
It's a stark example of that mix.
Absolutely. Sufi leadership, social protest, Kurdish identity politics, and regional power plays all tangled together.
Beyond specific movements like that, how did Sufism generally connect with Kurdish identity and social cohesion in Afrin before 2010?
They were really tightly interwoven. Sufi orders provided spaces where Kurdish culture, and importantly the Kurmanji language, could be maintained, even for migrants in Aleppo via connected zawiyas.
And the structure itself helped.
Yes, the Sheikh Murid relationship fostered loyalty, mutual support, a shared identity. The zawiyas were community hubs reinforcing those bonds. And as we said, the networks kept Afrin's Kurds connected even when they moved away, maintaining that collective sense of belonging.
How did these communities, with their strong Kurdish identity and Sufi structure, manage their relationship with the Syrian state, the Ba'athist regime, before 2010? That must have been tricky.
It likely required very careful navigation. The Ba'athist state in power since 63 was inherently suspicious of independent groups, especially those with ethnic ties, given its Arab nationalist focus and Arabization policies.
So the Sufi groups kept a low profile.
Probably often, yes. Focusing on devotion, community affairs. But we know some leaders, like Sheikh Mahmoud, did act as intermediaries with state authorities on local matters sometimes.
How did they frame themselves to the state?
likely emphasizing religious virtue, traditional authority things perhaps seen as less directly challenging than overt politics. This was different from some big national Sufi figures who had closer state ties.
So while the Murid movement showed Sufism could be linked to dissent,
in the pre-2010 period in Afrin, it seems Sufi communities function more as relatively autonomous spaces. Places to preserve Kurdish identity, social bonds, and local leadership within that religious framework, navigating the state carefully.
This has been incredibly insightful. We've journeyed through the pre-2010 Sufi world of Afrin, and it's clear it was a rich, complex tapestry.
It really was. You see how the different orders, especially the Rifa'iya and Naqshbandiya, shaped religious life, each with distinct leaders, practices, and networks.
The Zawiya stands out as such a vital community center. And those Sufi networks really were the glue connecting rural Afrin and urban Aleppo.
Absolutely. And the rituals, the dhikr, the embodied practices like the karamat, the importance of sacred sites like Nabi Huri show just how deeply Sufism was embedded in the culture and society.
And understanding the history, like the Murid movement, highlights that constant interplay between Sufism, Kurdish identity, and political forces.
Even under the Syrian state, these communities carved out important spaces for cultural continuity and social bonds.
Getting this picture of Afrin before 2010 feels really important, especially considering everything that came later. It gives us a crucial baseline.
It does, and it makes you wonder, what aspects of this deep-rooted history might still resonate today, even after all the upheaval? How does understanding this past shape how we see Afrin's present and perhaps its future?
That's definitely something for all of us to think about. A powerful note to end on.